Janice, and I'm going to lead our group discussion today with our elder, Bell Hayward. The last class period, we talked about the teenagers. And so today, if we could, I'd like to talk a little bit about your young adulthood years. You had mentioned about the VIA sending outside of your school, a trade school. Could you tell us a little bit about that and your life there, where it was, how long you were there?
When I left Middle Cala for that trip to the school, they had a big to do about it. And I was probably among the first students under the BIA program to do that. So that's when they started sending out, you know, students from all over, over 48 and up here. And since it was new, we didn't know what to expect, you know, we were getting into it. And my dad, I used to work at in that aviation products where I had all the fueling, delivering fuel to the homes there, from Pepe Station there, the big airport there, and the gas station, airport fueling, and fuel commercial airlines and military aircraft. I did that for about 4 years. Right after I got married. Then we decided I was going to go to school. And it was kind of a, I don't know if I told you, but it was kind of a, up in the air whether I'd go or not. Because I wanted to be a fisherman. And I talked with that for a long time. And I told my dad I wanted to be a fisherman. He was going to help me, so if he decided to do that, he'd be all help me too. But I had a way in my mind, the fishing industry at the time was pretty down. And even then, under those circumstances, I still wanted to be a fisherman. And then I finally, when I discussed it with my wife, and she said, well, I know how much you care about fishing. You weigh the pros and cons of going to school and you remain in the fishing business. And we never did decide, discussing about it. And I said, well, let's flip a coin. I took a quarter and I said, heads, I go to school, tails, I stay back and try to make a life in the fishing business. I had two kids at the time. They were very small. I think one was 2 years old and the other was just born about the time we made that decision. And we immediately got into it and because I had to file my application with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and it was just a matter of weeks and like everything was kind of rushed. I acquired a car at that time, so I decided, hey, I want to take that with me. And Dad agreed to take that car to Canada for me, so I'm going to get one. That's how we transported all our belongings. And I set up the car for the trip, and so I had to provide a place for my kids to sleep. And I put a piece of plywood on the back. It was just a little Ford Falcon sedan. It was a very, compact car. I put a piece of plywood on the back window all the way to the front, on the back of the front seats. It was like a platform back there. It was only about that high, that much room. And I stuffed a lot of our belongings underneath that, and I got a rack and put it on top and piled everything on top. And I thought tires that were going to last me the whole 2 years that I'm going to go to school. Planned this all more in advance. So I bought tires for that car. It was brand new at the time. Bought a lot of oil, kind of stuff I needed for maintenance on my car. And we took everything we owned, which wasn't much at the time, it was the start of our life, and got everything in that car. When my dad took us across, he knew we were traveling, and I was worried about, can I go fast enough in this car? Because, you know, I didn't know how fast it would go. I thought that, you know, around town there, we just drive around at any max 25 miles an hour. And we go up the airport, 40, 45. MPOs, you know, it wasn't that easy. And I was all loaded down with all this stuff, and I had to talk to the dealer and a lot of other people, and there were not very many people on cars back then. And I didn't have any idea how well it would perform on the road, you know, but it did well. At first, you start off at 35, 40 miles an hour. You weren't even going to steam at 55 at the time. You thought you were zooming along, you know. But after you get used to it, you know, your speed creeps up and you adapt it to it. By the time I reached the lower 48, I was doing 65 miles an hour. I had a blowout, and we were going to Los Angeles. That's where I got to go to school. And I had a blowout, just really hot that day, over 100 degrees. Doing that, you know, about 65, 70 miles an hour, and blew the tire out. And we couldn't change the tire right away because it was just so hot to touch, I couldn't touch the rim or anything. I couldn't take the tire out. The tire of the car. So we had to sit there until it cooled down. It took about a couple hours, maybe 20 if we had it. And I had to fix the tire right there, and I had a lot of experience in that, you know, working at service station, you know, like that. So I mean, that was one of the things I did there. So I brought tools along, knowing that at some point in time I may have to, you know, repair a tire, and that's what I did. So I got that off by hand, you know, the tire irons that allow you to do that. And replace that tire with a new tire. Once we got down to L.A., it took us about maybe 5 days all the way from Mount California, from Prince Rupert. About 5 days. And we stayed right in the car, slept in the car, just on the floor there. Hotels or anything like that. But once we got down there, we got down there late in the evening, I think, I remember, so 8 o'clock. And we just got off the freeway, and we got the radio on. There was a big pile of, just right at the ramp, off ramp we took in downtown L.A. Just heard it just a matter of seconds after as we were, probably still on the ramp, off ramp. You know, you can see or hear them. We knew where it was because we just went still at times. All the different locations, the off ramp. And everything just got pretty soon the sign that we took point up, and it happened right in that area. There was over 100 car pilot. We missed that one. We didn't get involved, and it's going the same direction we were. It scared the heck out of us. remember the interior of the room. It was, you know, all these old wiring that in the old buildings a long time ago, they had these little porcelain standoff. And they had these wire was external. It was, you could see it all right out in the open. Right in the middle of the room, they had this bulb. Jerk string, turn off, switches. And we, and for the first time, you know, I've never been in a hotel like that, where we shared a bathroom with an adjoining room. I met another tenant. That was a new experience. It happened to be an old Navajo woman. She was in there. Dressed with a normal dress. I remember seeing them in geography books, like, you know, they were going to use the moon right away, you know, braided hair and long skirt, and went down to the ankle. And she wore these moccasins. And apparently she was going to school too, you know, she was coming off a reservation. So we ran into all kinds of things like this. And we had nothing to eat all day, so it was getting late, so I went out by myself to look for a restaurant or trying to get hammered or something. And I went into this restaurant, and for the very first time, I ran into a prejudice. I walked in this hotel, and it was a senior artistry. And you know, just walked in and went to the counter and I said, I want to order something to go. And this waitress saw me and turned around and left. I don't mean she was there, she's serving something else right now. So I stood there, and I must have stood there for 15 minutes and just, you know, completely ignored me. Like I went to there. And then I realized when it was happening. And they were, they didn't want me there. They didn't want to do business with me. And I realized for no reason. It was the first time I had a eerie feeling put in that situation. Right. But I talked to the waitress and said, can I get an order? And she wouldn't do anything for a while. She kind of walked away and came back. And I didn't know what else to do, but now the tenants are all staring at me. And I got irritated because I knew what they were doing. Mad and I guess she heard the irritation in my voice and seemed to find didn't want nothing to happen. I made it obvious that I was upset, you know. And I said, I want the forehand or the French fries or and I stood there until it was done, you know, I didn't sit at a booth or anything like that, or a camp. I stood out there by the cash register. Waited for the county guard and brought it over. And I was really upset because when I guess my wife noticed it when I got back to the room, she had told her what happened. And her and I, at that point in time, almost decided to go back home. Upset I was about the whole thing. And I went to bed and got up next day. Calmed down, called the BIA office and told them we're here and they told us where to go, you know, to their office there in LA. So we went there. And I talked to one of the people there and mentioned what happened with me. ago. Then I found out later, once we got in school, and got settled in that community, it was my housing. We, from time to time, ran into those kind of situations all the time up down there. So that kind of isolated us from the normal. You know, all those Native kids that were down there, from the lower 48, kind of bonded and stuck together. And we learned how to socialize and went as a group. That's what we knew if we went out singing, we'd be in trouble. And that circumstance created a bonding among all of the Natives, and a long, lifelong friendship developed out of that. The school, I mean, the BIA, when they didn't tell us, we got down there. It was a minimal amount of support down there. We got things, they gave us a room and board, and we got to buy cooking stuff and stuff like that that we needed down there. Like Salvation Army or secondhand store, even our clothing and stuff like that. Had a couple of years. We didn't say anything about it. Not do anything about it. And finally, we get together and we compare notes. Finally, we went down to the BIA as a group and said, we don't like where we're being treated. Set up in Alaska with the BIA and treatment stuff, right? So that was our protest. We just, like I say, went as a group, and they all got a spokesperson. When they saw how we reacted, I guess they treated, we got this kind of concluded that this is the way they treated the Indians down below. We didn't get that kind of treatment here a lot. So after we reported, we saw changes come along. Their attitude toward us changed. But so we kind of, like a pioneering group, we went through all this. It was silent, it was, we found out later that a lot of those people before us, particularly those that lived down there, they saw a change, in Oklahoma, Washington, and stuff like that. And it came, of course, but they saw the change come about. But we, all the time we were down there, we did everything together, as a group. There was probably, I would say, all together in the different trade schools. We had various trade schools. There was a tenant down there, probably in a lot of Alaskans, a lot of Natives. And I would guess all together we had probably 150 students. In our electronic course, there was about 30. Now, I'm going to say something about the educational system here, too, is that at that time, we had a lot of what I thought was top-notch people. In our group. Smart. back on it today, and I said, you know, it kind of fit the profile of the way that the natives were treated, you know. And then I realized, because of they were put in this situation, why we have the problems, social problems we have today among the natives. And they feel they're treated like this, and then a lot of them, especially those in Lower 48, since they were treated like that, they accepted that treatment. And that's wrong, because they weren't allowed to grow, you know, mentally. And therefore, there's a lot of smart people that, you know, have all the same the mind is a terrible thing to waste. There was a lot of that. A lot of waste time. Out and go on to higher education. Now, this was the highest level of education that we had at the time, program that I was in. Not a college. That wasn't even a consideration, college education. A lot of us wanted it, but it wasn't a consideration. There was no money for that, no support for that. It came in time. Well, after I got out of it, so now you're progressing. It took a long time. There was one exception to that, and there was one native from, I think it was Washington. He had to have like a genius level mind. He was the only one that was out of all our group that was allowed to go into the college education level. So a guy with a B average or a C average, you know, which is where I was. I'm a C average guy, but with a lot of effort and drive, you jack yourself up to BB plus. That's what I did. Let's see, there was a lot of stumbling blocks put in our way. See, that kind of explains why we're in the position we are in relation to the modern culture. It took me a long time to put pieces together. You know, smell the coffee, so to speak. A lot of it just recently. And, you know, people of your age are knowing that your knowledge base already has this while you're in school, and which required me to be a, you know, to get that same knowledge base growth. That had to happen up to 40, 50, 60 years old. And with a lot of experience. So the educational process, even though if you're in a structured environment, depending on your, that's good because now you're safe. Now you have really nothing to worry about, but you're total attention to learning. And I say that wasn't available to me. You know, I had to leave that here at the same time that school. And that was a mantra of my age group. And I have good kids, and everybody in that whole school, a lot of us started late. I got back in school when I was 27. Got back into the curriculum, structured type of education. what I learned is about life and everything like that is just my life experience. One way or another, you're going to learn it. You know, it'll take a long path, do what I did, I had to do. By the time you're before you're 30, you're gonna have the knowledge base you need after achieve at 40, 60 years old.
So Bill, would you say that by at the young age that you were, by the BIA implementing a program to send you outside for a trade school, do you then or now have, and do you think that maybe that was a way of assimilating you into mainstream America, especially
in that? You know, it was. You know, I said I dug after I ran into a situation down in South Dakota, you know, I told you nothing about it. I started digging into the history. Reading books, you know, reading about my background, Cincinnati, and in many cases, I like when I finish a book, I sit there and all go with my mind, you know. I've had this internal rage, you know, because I start, when you start putting the pieces together, it was by design, I think it happened that way. The United States did this for a reason. And, you know, just like we're doing with the Iraqi oil. It's by design that we had that war. It's by design they had the war with the Indians. They had something that they wanted. The Indians had something that they wanted. I can say, well, I came to this conclusion after I retired. And once I realized that, it was just like, it snapped together because you're building this big puzzle of life, slowly assembling it, like a thousand piece puzzle, and you don't know what it is until you get to a certain point and you've got enough pieces together, and you, hey, this is the way you can come to almost reach the conclusion that you're still building. This is what you guys are doing, right? You know, through the education process, putting these pieces together. That's behind, you know, like I say, initially when I find these things out, I rage internally, and then that's the way it is. But, you know, now you got something to compare with. Just like that video machine there, your mind and your wife, it's like a machine that never shuts off, and from the day you were born until the day you die, gathering this information. A lot of it you don't know the reason why. Even now, like, you know, you're gonna run into things like this in school, you don't understand it until maybe you're 10 or 13, 14, 15 years into the job market. And you're going to go, oh, no, I know why that structure is because why we get this in our class. Or my dad said this, or my grandmother said this. You may have remembered picking up that piece of information that it didn't lock in, right?
some of what you've talked about sort of sounds like culture shock to me. When you're a young family in America for the first time, probably the community and the state, and it must have been real strange going into LA. I mean, it is for me today. So how did you feel that?
You know, initially I thought it was, there's a lot of things, even like in Seattle, we ran into, when I used to spend a year down there, or I'd go down half the summer and and work down there, got jobs down there. And I went to school a couple of times down there, never finishing. It wasn't until I got married and got a sense of responsibility that I said, I'm going to finish. More of a shock to her because that was the first time she ever went on in Alaska.
How about your traditional foods? Did your family send
you? You bring that up. Even as children, our grandparents used to send up care packages, we call them, and things like that. And what happened there is that the staff members there would take that package and cut it up into pieces. And, it wasn't supposed to be just for us, but yet we had to, as part of our learning, and learn how to share. And then, but that's what they did. They took all that food and did dirt with all the rest of it. Anyway, down there, they shipped us. They knew that we'd miss that, parents, grandparents, so we get healthcare packages like that all the time right now. And especially during the season, the Christmas, Thanksgiving.
So what would be included in these care
packages? Dried fish, seaweed. Pilot bird is not available in the low 40.
And it still is.
But you grew up with our cabin, we had boxes and boxes of pilot bird. I mean, that pilot bird's the same today as it was back then. The school, okay, I know up here I found out later that the university here gave the same course, it's an industrial electronic course, delves and transmitters, TV, radio, computers, computer logic. Then when I started school, vacuum tubes, which was, you guys know as integrated circuits today, was replaced by solid state, and later on by microminiature circuits. But the theory of operation of all the same today, 50, 100 years ago, all the same. New technology comes in. Now we got the video camera, and we got the TV. I was interested in the electronics first mainly because the TV, color TV was just starting. We had nothing but black and white at that point. I remember running into the black and, I mean, first TV, color TV. Which Cuba, I saw with him, Edison Tech in Seattle. He had it out on display in his big window in the school. And I was the only one then who was breaking technology at the time. And so when we went to school, it was named black and white. And you got a smattering of color theory toward the end. Coming things from the get some kind of introduction to it, and then later on pick up some course beyond the 2 years that we were there, which is what we did, a lot of it. So we had to keep up with the ongoing technology. It was on-the-job training. You took up courses on your own, you had to stay ahead of it. Luckily, the job I had that OJT program, it was second to none. And, you know, we got certifications and all these different things as they came along. You can give you these certification cards, it's like a little diploma. And I had 8 of them. Like a degree, you know, and then because you could use it that way in our field. So when you go move to another station or another, another field, you can show this and take it over. It serves the same purpose as a degree, you know, diploma.
How long were you in LA in that school?
22 months.
Could you give us a little bit of a description? I maybe said it, I just didn't catch it. As far as what it was like, you said there were several different trades that were taught.
We started out in radio receivers, you know, AM radio, FM radio. And each course was 3 months long. Finish that, and then we moved. Since that was kind of give, when you got through with radio, that gave you a pretty good background going into television. The circuits are the same. The model's the same. All, you know, oscillators and generators and all the stuff that you use, you know, the circuit that we developed up to that time. That some will pass and others, and there's, you know, kind of like you're fired. So you learn all these different circuits, and then probably you have a memory of some like 200 circuits generally used in the electronic field. Then we went into, from there, from TV, and we went into math. We had to use it in like designing stuff, you know, the way engineers would do it. We had to understand the language that they so we can communicate back and forth with engineer level type people. And then we went into transmitters. TV transmitters, radio transmitters. All kinds of transmitters, like portable radio and stuff like that. Again, that particular field has a lot of common circuits using all the different types of transmitters. And some software different things a lot of there. Different powers and things like that. You gotta know how to do that. Again, at a level that you can communicate had 4 months of, we had to take up, just like you guys do, you had to take up, you know, not only your major, but you had to take up English and math and, you know, in addition to that. Everybody had to do that.
Was it like the students who live on campus here, was the housing and everything on?
We lived in LA. You know, we had apartments.
Close to the school.
Close to the school, or to at least to a bus service, you know, that, to your school. I lived 150 blocks from the school. After that, we were afraid, we used to visit friends on the other side of Watts, but you wouldn't go through Watts because we were scared, because, you know, it was the shortest way, you know, through, I mean, the street, the firestorm, but I don't think it went very close to where we had been, you know, out through to another town on the other side. We went all the way down town, 3 A-50, back up, looped around with that to visit our friends. Stay that way for quite a while. But in the 60s, that was common all over the United States. Big uprising. The black people said, enough's enough. At the same time, the space program was on. It started. They first had the, when I was first started going to school, they had the first unmanned satellite. And that's the main reason they started the training program we had, because the space industry was just blossoming, taking off. By the time we got through to school, we had a bombardment of employers coming to our school, even trying to entice them to get out of school and one day at a time, offering big money. And, should I go here? I should, you have a choice of where you want to go. Should I go to this place or this place? And we all wanted to come back to Alaska, so all of us knew. Native Alaskan family went and got a job. originally planned to work only 18 months out there just to build up my resume and move on. That was my original plan. And mainly because at the time when we started out there, the pay wasn't all that good. I couldn't even support a family on it. And I, at that time, had 4 kids. So on the, when I got out of school, we dropped off my, I dropped my family off in Delicatessen on the way up here, and they can visit. And I came up here because we had an open up here. They wanted us up here right away, so we left our families in Delicatessen on the way up here. The whole winter was good. None of us had any money, so we pooled our money together and. Five of us had a one-room apartment. Got the name of that hotel. It's no longer in existence. The building's partially there. And this is what all of us lived in. Stuff on the floor. We paid $50 a week. Man, that was a lot of money. We couldn't afford that, you know. We got into discussions later, how we can get our families up here. We got to worry about playing clear up and, you know, then it was like $500 or $600 per person. And for a long time, I worried about that. I worked for a month and a half up here before we finally figured out how we're going to do that. We didn't have any housing. We stayed in that hotel for a long time. And they bus, they used to bus us out to work 13 and a half miles to each other every day. And we got here in February, still quite cold, 20 below, 15 below night. And when they took us out to the site, you know, these old school buses like they had, you know, the standard school bus, the windows would be all fogged, you know, iced up. So when we left the hotel and got on the bus, went to work, didn't know how we got there, you know, because you can't see nothing. And so for the longest time, we had no idea how to get out there. You know, we got your own car or that thing, right? Because with what happens, they went all over town to pick up all these different people that worked out there. So it's been an hour and a half in the bus and waiting. You know, drop the road. And like I say, a month and a half, and one of us finally got a car in our group. And we actually had to help them out. You know, and we had the loans from that company. We couldn't get loans from banks and others. The company had to step up and loan us some money. Like I said, it didn't pay us well. The only reason we kind of, which enticed us to stay there, we turned union. Immediately our pay went up double, triple, quadruple in a very short time. Now we don't want to leave. We're paying a really good one. You know, that's a bargaining unit. And it stayed that way for a long time. And it had a big effect on our retirement program. So when we established our retirement program, and you had to go into a catch-up mode. In other words, like a lot of us, like myself, I was 20, 29, you know, almost 30 years old, and I never started a retirement program at all. And I realized that, you know, going to an accelerated ourselves that we take additional $4 an hour out of our pay. It's retirement program. By that time, we were making $8, and we were making $80 up to $100,000 a year. And when we started, when I was making $9,000 to $9,000 a year. But that was a big jump we made. So it was easy for us to set that money aside and come up with this accelerated program. So by the time we all were sort of thinking about 50, 55, you know, that you can have
a long way away.
That might be when you live that long. But then we're all thinking like that because we're all young men. But it comes fast.
I'm going to ask just one last question, and then I'll let everybody else ask questions, okay? At the beginning of class, you mentioned that when those of you decided to leave Metlakatla and go to this school in California, that there was a big to-do with their... Did you guys have a party, or did you celebrate something?
Yeah, they... Well, see, it's the church, I mean, the church is where we have this party, so you know, they're very religious back home. You know, this was something that I thought was unique. Out of all the native kids that were down there, I realized the program that we were in was an accelerated program. And they told us at the very beginning that if you missed one day, you would be too far behind to catch up on the remainder of the course. And you won't graduate. That's the first thing they told us. So this is a highly concentrated effort here, you know, and then the reason was that they needed technicians bad. So we had a percentage average of the native population down there attending the schools to graduate. You're talking 90-95%. You know, because we all realize, you know, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity, and we never see another thing like this. And so you had all the reason in the world to try to succeed. And that's what happened. You know, they were looking at like 30-40% success rate. And they were considering that good. You know, the projection was when they had that high a percentage rate, you know, they just keep doing this.
Anybody else have any questions?
I was sort of curious about how many Alaskans were sent out?
In my field, it was about 30.
And this was all with electronics?
Yeah, this course that I mentioned.
And then, so the 30 that went down, how many came back to run?
I would say 80-90% of the graduates, of, you know, native graduates.
And then when you build out your application to be accepted by, some of you might not know what BIA is. Do all of you know?
No.
It's the Bureau of Indian Affairs, run by the government of the United States.
So the Bureau of the what?
Bureau of Indian Affairs. And they felt obligated to provide services to the people that lived in these lands and the lands that they took away from them. So they established that portion of the government. But so do you think for the people that were sent from Metlakatla, how many returned to Metlakatla? Because you're in Fairbanks.
There was only two of us actually from Metlakatla. Well, actually more. There was other two in the electronic field in my class. And he really wasn't from Metlakatla. He married somebody from Metlakatla. And he went to the same program I did. John Bergenhead. He's an ad school. Yeah, he went from St. Lawrence Island. And he went down there and he graduated as well. And we came up together up here. And we kind of stuck together even down there. He married my first cousin. We were pretty close. So we helped each other. In fact, he got a car before it, and so he had to transport us all over the place. You know. Well, actually, I had my car. Yeah, and I used to ferry them around until they got his car. And I'm saying, yeah, he got a bigger car, so he had to use it a lot. Because we had a big group to haul around. But until that happened, like when he used to come home on vacation, we had a vacation about 2 months after we got started school. We hit the school down there 2 months before the vacation season came along. So you could start anywhere in this course, halfway, a third of the way, quarter of the way, and you're going to make the loop all the way through it from where you started. And finish there. And your start time and finish time and determine when you they're always repeating these 3 month courses around all the time. Mm-hmm. And you just jump in like a merry-go-round, jump in. So when you drop down there, the cycle is almost complete, and after 3 months you're down there. And then you decide, well, we checked out of our apartments, you know, because we didn't want to pay rent or home on vacation, so we decided to drive home. I actually drive to Seattle and fly home. Metlakatla isn't that, it's only about an hour and a half flight, you know, from Seattle. So to save time, we first arranged to get on a fishing boat, and we want to make a little money while we're home. You know. So I got on a boat, and we said, come up here as soon as you can. So we drove all the way to Seattle and got everybody on the plane and flew them home, all our kids and my wife, all the way. And got them home. We went home and got right on the boat and stayed there. And we got a 3 week vacation, so we just fished all the time. And then as soon as the fishing season went north, but that guy said, did real well, and we made a lot of money. So that was a big help for us down there. We boosted on Bergamaschi night, flew back to Seattle, and drove down and got to find another apartment. See, the airport, the Ketchikan Airport, used to be on our island. They used that old, military base there at the airfield there. And during the war, the Second World War, always had at least 20,000 men on that base. And they were ferrying warplanes to the Aleutian chain all through Canada and into Alaska.